Welcome back to another episode of the Half Court Press Podcast. Hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving. Mine was good. Chris?
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was my brother and sister-in-law. My sister-in-law had their first baby. So we drove into Iowa and out of Iowa in the same, and they like came home that day. So we like were there, said hi, had a smaller Thanksgiving lunch, right. And then we got out of there so nice. That they could have their. But so it was good.
It's a fun week always for me as a basketball fan. Although like there's other responsibilities. Like I would love to just sit in front of a TV from Monday to Friday and just watch all these tournaments that there's wild results, upsets, crazy things. But I can't, one, because it's a football state, and when I'm with family, they all just want to watch like the Cowboys play or whatever. And so I feel bad about changing the channel to see what's going on with Michigan, North Carolina. But, you know,
I'm the same way.
I fight that battle. And then you're also like with family. Like, do I need to sit in front of a TV all the time?
But. It's also like, you know, those weeks in high school or in college when you had just like four exams and a paper, and it was just like hell week, you know? That's kind of what it feels like as a reporter in this state on Thanksgiving week, because you're like, okay, I have to figure out how I'm going to do Thanksgiving and also cover the football team, and oh my gosh, there's three games for basketball. And so it was one of those things where like on Sunday, I had to like, okay, let's see what happened in the basketball world while I was drowning.
Recap.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, hopefully everyone had a good holiday. Yeah. And yeah,
thanks. And it's Creighton, Nebraska week.
I was going to say, all of a sudden, here it is. Nebraska and Creighton are playing each other on Saturday.
Didn't it feel like it snuck up?
To me, it did.
Yeah, I didn't realize it till last Friday or last Saturday. I was like, oh my gosh, I'll be a week from now.
Right, and that's just the way the season goes sometimes. So we are going to record, we're recording one today, a podcast today on Monday. And this is kind of, I think, more of a summary sort of look back, kind of peek ahead a little bit podcast, whereas we'll record again later this week, I think on Thursday, which will be a full-on Creighton-Nebraska preview, where we just dive into the matchups and all the different storylines that are going on with those two teams. So we'll get to Nebraska in a moment, 2-1 in the Cayman Islands. I would imagine that qualifies as a success for the Huskers. We'll talk about that in a moment, but first, we'll start with Creighton. The Jays were completely obliterated in a game against San Diego State to open the Las Vegas Challenge. But then 24 hours later, Creighton recovers and upsets Texas Tech in overtime, 83-76. Sort of a wild back-to-back, you know, I guess 85 minutes of hoops for the Jays. And I guess encouraging. I don't really know.
I was going
like,
to say,
it's hard to pull an assessment out of that.
Let's start with San Diego State. Like, so there was a big run at the end of the first half, right?
18-0.
So what happened?
San Diego State.
Because I imagine it was pretty close, and then at a certain point, something broke.
Yeah. So I think the two concerning things out of that matchup, which we'll be looking at as the season rolls along for the Jays, were number one, San Diego State had a 6'10" forward who didn't necessarily stretch the floor, but his ability to see the floor, to pass out of double teams, to hurt Creighton when he wasn't doubled or when he had an advantage situation. Yanni Wetzel is his name. You know, he changed the game, I thought, for San Diego State on offense, because the Jays were constantly in recovery, it seemed. And it opened things up for a guy like Matt Mitchell. I think his name is Matt Mitchell. Mitchell was who torched Creighton, it seemed, for much of the game. And I think gave Malachi Flynn for San Diego State some opportunities, too. So I thought that mismatch at the four proved problematic for the Jays. And that probably will be an issue for the rest of the season. Now, Denzel Mahoney's 6'5", thicker guard with a longer wingspan than Mitch Ballack. So he will help the Jays there. But I do think that when the Jays face a similar mismatch, now, I don't know how many players are going to see like Wetzel, but just that idea of having to contort its defense to deal with a guy that size, that was an issue. And the other thing was San Diego State's physicality. Like Coach McDermott mentioned after the game, and I think after the game on Friday too, was just the Jays, in terms of setting screens, running cuts, just running their offense, they were knocked off balance too often, or they weren't assertive enough and just ready for that, you know, the disruption that San Diego State was going to cause. Like the Aztecs were fighting over the top of screens at times. They were, you know, they'd swipe down on those dribble handoffs that you see, like a big hands off to a guard at the top of the key or something like that, and the guard would come off and try to swipe down and disrupt that handoff to make sure it's not clean. Just the way that they were use their body to knock Creighton's guards off their track when they're running around cuts. I think that just that physicality, and San Diego State had enough of rim protection to take some chances on the perimeter, extend its guards out, and really take away what the Jays wanted to do, which was shoot threes. And on top of that, by the way, Tyshawn Alexander and Marcus Zagorowski were 6 of 27, and they missed good shots too in that. So when the Jays needed a big shot to kind of change the game or keep the momentum from going completely to San Diego State, they kind of get it.
Yeah, and that was one thing when I looked up, okay, because I saw the score and I was like, okay, wow, that seems a little much. And then, you know, you pull up KenPom and, you know, they're San Diego State's, you know, 19th in effective field goal percentage and 18th in three-point field goal defense. And my first thought was like, okay, that makes sense. Like, that's the team that would disrupt Creighton to a point where, like, I didn't watch it. Was there a point where Creighton was trying to get 10 points on one shot? Like, trying, you know what I mean? Like, trying to force threes and trying to actually
a
get
little
it?
Bit.
Or was it just one of those things where they just went cold and the other team got
hot?
Yeah,
and they really couldn't get great looks for most of the game. And I think a lot of it, you credit San Diego State for it, the way it plays defense. But then also, I think the Jays just weren't as – they kind of just allowed it. They were just like, all right. Mm-hmm. This is how it's gonna go, you know, and they weren't sort of forcing the issue. Now they were. That was what Coach McDermott and the players talked about after Texas Tech, was that they were more sort of kind of, I don't know, you just put your head down, sort of kind of like flex your muscles and say, like, we know you're gonna get up in this and try to make it uncomfortable. We're not backing down, and we're gonna try to run our stuff no matter what. And I think that they were better at that. And as a result, against Texas Tech, now they did shoot the lights out to start the game. But as the game wore on, especially late in the second half, they got more two-point shots and more chances at the rim, I think, because they were able to partly because Texas Tech was stretched out, but also because they were just more aggressive. And Marcus Zagorowski was the case in point of that, because he scored 32 points against Tech, and, you know, I think he only got nine of those from the three-point line. You know, he or maybe it was six. I can't remember if he hit two or three threes, but he was super aggressive going downhill. You know, he got to, instead of settling for a jumper at like 15 to 17, he got to like 10 to 12 and either hit a floater or a fadeaway J or got all the way to the rim. So I think that just a mentality change was what was noticeable about the Jays.
Like, they got punched and then the next day they actually punched back. You know what I mean?
Because
I think it's
because they did get, because Texas Tech did punch them.
Right.
Because that's how they play.
I was going to say, that's the interesting thing that of saying, you know, that they didn't deal with San Diego State's physicality very well is, I think Chris Beard is one of the top eight coaches in college basketball. And because he gets his guys to play like that on the defensive end. And so I imagined that they were going to play that way. So they did this. So Creighton just handled it better, or they actually punched.
Yeah. I think they just handled it a lot better. And then, you know, I don't know whether it was fatigue or just the momentum that Texas Tech rode in the second half. The Jays were suddenly in a dogfight after leading by as many as 19 in the first half. They obviously had to find a way to win, and they did with some hustle plays and some big time plays in overtime. So you credit them for that. But I think the question about this team kind of going forward after watching them in Vegas is about, you know, their offense in terms of running it with the amount of efficiency that they want to against teams that are really physical and long and kind of pride themselves on being really tough defensively. How did the Jays, can the Jays still attack the way they want to? And they didn't get, I didn't feel like Creighton got a lot of in transition. So a lot of it was in the half court, and you know, they obviously have to find ways to be a little bit more efficient, because defensively, There's a lot.
Yeah,
they got a lot of room to grow, a lot of work to do. Again, Denzel Mahoney not being part of the rotation is one factor. Davion Mintz is one of their better perimeter defenders. Adding him back when he gets healthy from a high ankle sprain will help. But I do think their issues may be a little bit more. They're a little bit more than just the addition of two players.
Right.
So
there are fundamental things on defense you have to do.
They've plummeted down the efficiency ranks in terms of their defense, according to Ken Pomeroy's statistics since the start of the season. And a lot of that has happened in the second half of games. Like Texas Tech came out and just started, felt like did whatever it wanted to against the Jays in the second half. So that will be something to watch over the course of the next.
And they get Oral Roberts tomorrow?
Oral Roberts is up next, and we'll see. I don't know how much of a
contest.
It's hard to say. It's a game that will go up and down most likely because of the way Oral Roberts plays. I mean, it's like top 25 in adjusted tempo so far this year, and it'll attack and transition when it can and push tempo when it can, and it doesn't necessarily have the same makeup of a San Diego State and Texas Tech. So some right. of the things that showed up in those games in Vegas for the Jays, I don't know if Oral Roberts or Nebraska certainly will test the Jays in that way. So we won't know.
Nebraska won't, I don't think.
Yeah. We won't know how much they've improved in that area probably until they play Oklahoma at home and in those areas. The things that stood out in those games against Texas Tech and San Diego State, like we won't know.
You'll learn a lot from December 17th to December 22nd. That's Oklahoma and Arizona State.
Yeah.
Because I think Arizona State plays pretty hard too.
Right.
You know?
It's, you know, Creighton, there's obviously a lot of questions about what this team can be and how long can Marcus Zagorowski, Tyshawn Alexander, and Mitch Ballack sort of like drive the bus for this team the way that they have. But when you look across the Big East, I mean, you know, again, we'll find out what kind of impact Davion Mintz can make once he's healthy and what role Denzel Mahoney has as a transfer becomes eligible at the end of the semester. I think talking to the players and the coaches, they think it can be rather significant, those two guys, just adding them in and taking some of the workload off their top three guards and being able to more effectively establish their pace with added numbers and two of their better athletes on the whole roster. You add those guys in, they're encouraged by that possibility. But because I think Greg McDermott, man, I can't remember what game it was. It might have been like the second or third game. He referenced sort of like, I think he was he did it with a smile on his face. So it was kind of like half joking. But you know those like advent calendars that you like peel off the days of counting down till Christmas or whatever it is. That's what he was like. I'm peeling off the days of the calendar to where we get Davion Mintz and Denzel Mahoney.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I guess my point was that, I don't know, the Big East still feels completely wide open.
Yeah.
At this point, no one in the league has really, you know, we're through November, but no one in the league to from my perspective has really grabbed hold of it and said like we are the team to beat. Now, Seton Hall has played well against good competition.
Mm-hmm.
Villanova. You see the athletes all over the floor, and you think, well, that team, especially by January and February, is going to be really tough to beat. Butler started well, but I don't know if it has a signature win yet.
What about DePaul?
DePaul, again.
What's up with that?
Well, I was going to say DePaul, yeah. Xavier, Butler, they've all started well, but I don't know if they've picked up a signature win.
Yeah. They beat Iowa and they beat Minnesota, but I also don't know how good either of those teams
exactly.
are. Now, they played Texas Tech on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's, I think, what you learn if DePaul's for real or if they're not.
Yes, that would be their signature win.
Yeah,
moment. Yeah. I think Butler might have beat Stanford in Kansas City, but it's hard to know like
by one
what that is.
I agree.
I don't know.
Yeah,
what I mean, Stanford. I think it was undefeated at the time. So like you've seen, but I guess my point is that the league feels completely wide open. So if the Jays can address some of these issues quickly, show some improvement, but then also kind of get a boost with the addition of two guys, they actually have a chance to obviously compete at the top of the league. So
sure.
We'll see what they can do. To Nebraska.
Yes.
The Huskers.
2-1.
2-1 in Cayman Islands, beat Washington State, fell to George Mason, correct? And then rebounded with a win over South Florida.
Yeah, it was a interesting three games. In general, I made this spreadsheet because it's what I do, of how they played in those three games in the Caymans compared to their average for the whole season. Now, they shot 48% in the Caymans. They made 8.3 threes in the Caymans. They shot 40% from three, and that was kind of the difference. They on average, they shoot 34% from three, so shooting 40%, shooting 6% higher from three. Like, that's gonna win you some games. They made 10 threes against George Mason and lost. Mm. Now they made 9 against Washington State and won. So it's kind of one of those things where you have to hit the threes at the right point. I think the most encouraging part was, you know, with George Mason, they just looked like a different team than the night before. They looked a little sluggish. You know, they got out-rebounded by a million. But I think the encouraging part was coming back against South Florida, and kind of, they didn't necessarily dominate the game, but they were definitely in control. And they definitely, there wasn't really a point where you felt like Nebraska was going to lose hold of the game. And I felt like Fred was really pleased with that aspect of losing and then immediately returning, because what he said on Tuesday night after the loss to George Mason was, you know, hey, we learned what we're going to, how we're going to react to a win. Now we're going to learn how we're going to react to a loss. And they reacted really well. And I think that's one thing that, you know, we talked a lot about this last year about Nebraska dealing with adversity and dealing with difficult issues under Tim Miles, and they didn't deal with things hard. They didn't deal with hard things very well. And Fred has talked a lot about that with this team. But I think the fact that they lost their opening two games to UC Riverside and Southern Utah, and then went and then won three straight, and then got their butt kicked by George Mason, and then responded with a win, that to me says that, sure, they might have problems in game because they kind of get in a funk of kind of flipping the switch, but that's good coaching. The fact that you can lose like that with a team like that and then respond, you know what I mean? So I think that was really encouraging, the winning that final goal. And I had them going 1-2 in this tournament. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that they can steal a win almost in a way makes up for one of the earlier losses. If you're one of those people that's really interested in finishing 500 or, you know, trying to finish, you know what I mean? Like, you kind of steal one.
Yeah, but watching them in the Cayman, I'm just like, I still don't know how they lost the first two games.
Oh, I have no, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I think it
makes sense to think like, okay, there was going to be sort of a warm up for this team because it's new, this whole new roster and some guys who are jumping up a level. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I underestimated the difficulty of putting together a roster, essentially from scratch. That was their decision to kind of grab guys from all over and say, hey, we're going to start it from ground zero. I thought that maybe some of the issues might have been fixed. Those types of sort of like learning how to play together. That's what Italy was for. But
sure. I think a lot of it though was like, Game one and game two, especially game one, I think it was like, hey guys, this is what Division One basketball is. Like, you guys might think that you've got this nice Nebraska jersey on, you're playing in this big arena, but like, every team's going to come out and try and beat you. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't a drill. Excuse me. I was like not sneezing for like the last week, and then all of a sudden.
Yeah, we got like some dust.
But
in
I think what happened was they showed up that first game and they were like, oh, we'll win. Like, you know, we've got this great coach and like everything's fine. And then they got their butt kicked. And then now it's almost like the season restarted once they got that first win. You know what I mean? Because since then, I mean, they're 4-1. You know what I mean? So now they get Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech's pretty good. They're projected to lose by 10. Georgia Tech's 3-2. They beat NC State to open the season. And then their other two wins are against Elon and Bethune-Cookman. So they lost to Arkansas in overtime, which is actually a pretty good loss, and lost to Georgia. They're one of the best effective field goal percentage teams in the country. So I think that this is going to be a pretty tough game for Nebraska. But the one thing that I wanted to also point out, you know, we're going to talk about rebounding for years, for months with this team.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try and explore it later this week. But they, on average, get out-rebounded 42-29, and in the Caymans they were out rebounded on average in the three games 48-34. So like, they get their butt kicked. So, but that's the thing, they get their butt kicked on the boards, but they still went 2-1, right? So they're doing things well enough when they do get a rebound and they are able to get out in transition, and when they are able to run half court offense, that if they were able to somehow find a way to get a couple more boards a game, you know, right now, average score, it's 75.7 Nebraska, 75.3 opponents. You know, one or two rebounds, which is one or two more possessions. I mean, that can bump up. I mean, that's a difference between two or three more wins. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So that's kind of where they're at now. This is such a fascinating, interesting team to cover. As I told John right before we started, and we'll talk about the Big Ten later, they are the fastest offense in the Big Ten and the least efficient offense in the Big Ten.
According to KenPom,
yeah. Their average length of possession is about 15 seconds. They don't turn the ball over. They have a really good assist to turnover ratio. Like, they use their bench well. Everyone is somewhat efficient, but they just can't rebound.
Yeah.
And they can kind of defend, but they're, in terms of getting offensive rebounds, they're 342nd. In terms of making sure other teams don't get offensive rebounds, they're 349th. And there's like 353 college basketball teams.
Right. I bet if you dug into the numbers there, they might be the worst rebounding team
in
the country.
That's what I'm trying.
Like,
what
if
I'm
you really
look
looked
at
yeah. okay, who, what team? I mean, they're one of the worst teams in terms of getting defensive rebounds and then also getting offensive rebounds. So the only way to offset that is to be extraordinarily efficient on offense with your possessions, not turning over. Like you said, they probably still can stand to shoot better or get better shots, more high percentage looks, but they are scoring a lot in transition. They take a lot of shots in transition. So that's one way to do it. And then also defensively, you know, maybe you can force a few more turnovers. But
that's the thing. Not only can they not rebound, that's also possessions.
Yeah.
I'm curious of how few possessions Nebraska's actually had and how maybe impressive it is that they've won the games they have because of how fewer, like, they have to, maybe they're not efficient, but they're efficient enough that they're able to win games despite having, I mean, imagine, and this is a little bit different, but imagine if you're a football team and you get five less possessions than the other team, right? That means that if you win 21-17, that's so much more impressive because you probably turned the ball over five times. You know what I mean? Yeah. So for basketball, it's basically the same way where you're not, you know, turning the ball over in terms of a steal or throwing it out of bounds or whatever, but you just can't get a rebound and they get another chance.
Yeah.
And so it's so fascinating and interesting, and it's not fixable. Like, right now, it's not fixable. And I'm curious, we get to talk to Fred Hoiberg tomorrow, and I'm curious what he thinks you can kind of do with it. Because, again, it's not, you don't want to fundamentally change what you do because you've got Delino Banton, Derek Walker, and Shamil Stevenson on the bench. Those three guys might go 1-2-3 in terms of rebounding next year. Like, Shamil Stevenson, again, told me before the season he's the best rebounder on the team. So that's the thing where it's like, you can't really fundamentally change who you are because that they're going to come in and they're going to fix that issue next year. So it's just super interesting. And they're going to go play Georgia Tech. And I'm also curious about that game because in some ways, Nebraska's played better away from Lincoln. You know, they went undefeated in Italy. They went 2-1 in the Caymans. I think this is their first true, like, road trip. And I'm kind of curious what the setup is and what Fred does on road. You know, they went through pregame warm-ups or pregame, like, you know, strategy in the parking lot of the Cayman Islands Hotel that they were staying at. And so just kind of small things like that, like what's the process look like under Fred? But this is a 4-3 basketball team, but they're so, so damn interesting because they have all these layers to it. It's fascinating.
This game against Georgia Tech is part of the Big Ten ACC Challenge.
It is.
All the Big Ten teams are in action, and it's kind of a – it's always a prove-it week for the league, a chance to sort of affirm what has happened to this point. The ACC gets so much love nationally, and rightfully so. There's a lot of big-time programs there. But if the Big Ten can make a statement against the ACC, it suddenly kind of justifies or validates the league standing. And I get to that the selection committee claims that, hey, we're not going to look at your league as a whole when we assess your resume.
Sure they're not.
But they are going to look at each individual team within the league. So if you're a Big Ten team, you obviously want the other Big Ten teams to do well because then it gives you more opportunities to get quality wins in conference play.
Yep.
So if Indiana, Purdue, Wisconsin, and Ohio State are all performing poorly in non-conference, and suddenly these teams who you thought would be pretty good in conference, you don't get as big of a bump if you are able to beat them.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be it'll be important. I'm not quite sure. How do you assess the start of the league or start of the season for the Big Ten as a whole? Because I feel like the top has been really impressive.
Yeah.
Michigan State, Ohio State, Maryland, Michigan. The bottom, not as much. Even the middle, maybe not as much. Because teams like Wisconsin and Purdue haven't performed great.
Yeah. Michigan State has...
Indiana hasn't played anybody.
Michigan State has worried me more than I would want to be worried. Like, I think that they're getting tested early, which I think is good. And they have some guys out, which is... they've not been as, like, we're the number one team in the country, we're going to do... You know what I mean? Like,
we thought Michigan State, top of the conference, and then gap.
Yes.
Right? Is that what you thought?
That's true anymore. I think Ohio State's the real thing. I think Maryland is the real thing. I need to probably write a formal letter to Juwan Howard and apologize for doubting that he was going to work because they're 7-0.
Dude,
they're good. Okay.
I've been incredibly impressed with his coaching acumen, him and his staff's coaching acumen through the first month of the season.
Yeah.
Like the adjustments that they've made in games, and because I've watched a lot of them, I've been curious. I was curious as soon as Creighton played them. I'm like, okay, you know, they looked extremely good in the second half against the Jays, and I was like, how much of that is an anomaly? They've proven that a lot of it is not. He is benefiting, though, from having a force inside in John Teske. That dude is a monster defensively. I don't know. I've watched a decent amount of college basketball at this point. I think he's the best defensive center in the game. And then you have Xavier Simpson, who is one of the best point guards in terms of operating around ball screens and setting things up for his teammates. So he has Coach Howard he's gotten those two guys who have bought in.
Who are seniors. Three years under John Beilein.
And just as a whole, that team has this like winning personality because of, you know, the success they've had. So I think he entered into a great situation, but he has proven that, yeah, he's a good coach.
Just because you enter into it, and that's the thing too, is like you can inherit a lot of nice tools, but you can also kind of screw it up in some ways. So like...
And the other
not thing, to dunk on Mike Riley, but they still went 5-7 with a lot of those guys, and then the next year they went 9-4, like kind of proving you can win with other people's. But so you can mess it up in some ways. But I think even it doesn't matter who you are, you beat Iowa State, North Carolina, Gonzaga back to back to back. I mean, if John Beilein would have done it, we'd been like,
look
hey,
at
you
the
know, Big
scores
Ten
too. They like handled all those games. I mean, they were in control most of those games.
83-76, 73-64, 82-64 to Gonzaga.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They like they were in control all those games. So and like one of them, I think Xavier Simpson was out for because he fouled out. It's impressive. Now the question for Michigan is how much better can it get because they are so veteran that it's like. They might be at their peak already.
They
might just have to like kind of grind their way through the rest of the season. They're going to hit a lull at some point. That's part of it too. Maybe they're catching some of these teams that maybe are still kind of figuring things out and fitting things together.
Meanwhile, they are kind of already know.
Michigan knows who it is, even though it has a new coach and it's running a new system. Yeah. But that veteran piece has benefited Michigan.
But them juxtaposed with like Maryland, who is basically, you know. Not all youth, but a lot of youth.
Yes.
And they're kind of one of those wild card teams where they could come out and beat you by 30, or they could, I mean, they're Kentucky in a lot of ways, where they can beat you by 30, or they can come out and lose by, you know, 20 or whatever. Also, we've had a Kentucky loss at home, a Duke loss at home. Is that it? Did we get one?
I think those are the two major ones.
So
that, I guess your point is what? That anybody, Duke and Kentucky have lost to, not bad teams. Well, bad teams.
Yeah.
Evansville and Stephen F. Austin at home, but yet Maryland's 8-0. So is there something to
be
said for
that? Right, yeah. And so there's that point, and there's also, like, I'm trying to think of it in terms of, like, if Maryland and Michigan played, I could see Maryland winning by 20. I could see Michigan winning by 20.
The unpredictability
The total. And so I think that those are kind of the two favorites right now, with knowing that Michigan State's technically, you know, I think they're still in the top five in the AP poll, aren't they?
The new poll came out today. I didn't see where they landed, but
so you've got all that, and then you also, you know, Penn State beat Syracuse by like 20, so Penn State's looking good early.
No, I think Syracuse might be very bad though.
I think they might be as well, but still, Pat Chambers. Pat Chambers is 6-1. You can't take that away from them. They
went to Georgetown and won. I think Penn State.
Yeah, they're
did,
good. Penn right? State's good, and then you kind of have this, you know, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin. Rutgers is 6-1. There is usually kind of this pack in the Big Ten because it's so big of like, are they good? Are they not? And we'll kind of see. And then you've got Minnesota, who I don't think is good. Northwestern, who we know is not good. And Nebraska, who I think is kind of in between. We know that they're not good, and the and kind of the pack, you know.
Well, I think
so. We'll see.
And we know they're not good right now, but maybe there's a chance
they're fighting for like 12.
Yeah,
they're fighting to finish 12.
I mean, to start the year the way they did, 0-2 against those very bad teams.
Yeah,
that kind of says, oh, they're not good. But they obviously feel. If you watch them in the Caymans, you felt, hey, they're a different team than they were a month ago.
They are
improving. How much better can they get between now and February?
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to pump a bunch of hope because, again, this is not a great basketball team. But they're not as bad as they were day one.
Yeah.
And that's what Fred Hoiberg wants to say.
Right. So I think we talked a lot about Michigan. So Michigan-Louisville was like the headliner game for the Big Ten ACC Challenge. That's a lot of fun. What other game has caught your attention for this?
So I bolded some.
Yeah, what do you got?
Duke at Michigan State, obviously, because I don't know. I know both of those teams are good. I don't know if both of them are Final Four teams, and I think we'll learn something about them in December.
I'm not sure if either of them are either.
Notre Dame at Maryland. Can Maryland handle? Like, can Maryland just be
handle
Maryland?
The hype, I guess?
Yeah, can they just handle what they're kind of been given?
Right.
Ohio State at North Carolina.
I know, I like that one.
I like Chris Holtmann a lot. There was Michael Lewis was an assistant coach at Nebraska last year, and Lewis was with Chris Holtmann at Butler. And occasionally we would talk about Holtmann because, you know, he was kind of a big deal at Ohio State. And everything that Michael Lewis has told me about Chris Holtmann, it was just impressive. Like, he does it the right way. He's a great coach, in-game coach. And so I think Ohio State in the next two or three years is going to become, I mean, DJ Carlson's also like one of the best freshmen in the country. He can take over a game. To go at North Carolina, to win at North Carolina is tough anyway. North Carolina is in an interesting spot too, where, you know, they've dropped some games that you wouldn't necessarily expect North Carolina to drop.
Michigan.
But, yeah. I mean, just early, like it. You would expect where Michigan is with the new coach and North Carolina is that North Carolina would win. So I'm really curious about that game. Mostly because I'd love to see Ohio State go in there and win. Just to kind of say, just that could be a moment for Chris Holtmann to be like, we're for real. Like, we're not going to be kind of okay this year. Like, we're going to be actually really good.
You mentioned Ohio State sport guard DJ Carton. He's a Bettendorf, Iowa kid, I think, or the Quad Cities, I think is where he's from. And man, he's been an incredibly impressive freshman. This whole freshman class across college basketball, there's a lot of standouts.
There are
across the country.
There are,
and so that'll be him against Cole Anthony, North Carolina. That's going to be,
which is great because whenever you know that the class isn't that great, when you have, I call them a push notification guy. So we've had them in the last 2 years. One was Trae Young. Every time he scored more than 20 points, I got a push notification on my phone that said, "Hey, Trae Young got 20 points against Baylor," and it's like I didn't need that. That was a waste of space on my phone. And then last year was Zion. Hey, Zion dunked. It was a cool dunk. One of his 15 dunks in the game. Cool dunk, Zion. And it was one of those things where, like, okay, you're going to forget the rest of the freshman class because you have those dominant figures.
Right.
We don't have a push notification guy anymore.
Like it, no.
I've not gotten a push notification about a freshman
there
yet.
It is, right.
So I don't think we've got one. So we've got all these nice ones from Kentucky and Duke and North Carolina.
Yeah.
Even KU. KU hasn't really. I mean, they've got some good freshmen, but not a push notification guy.
Right.
And I like that. I like when it's spread out evenly.
Yep. Florida State and Indiana might be a good game. Florida State has beaten Purdue, Florida. They lost to Pitt to start the year, but like that team, I mean, I don't know. It just seems that they always assemble a ton of athletes and make it miserable. But for Indiana, it's kind of like this is Indiana's chance to like.
They haven't played anybody.
They played nobody.
They've played nobody at all
so far. So is Indiana for real? We'll find that out.
Which might be good for Archie Miller to have played nobody so far.
Maybe.
Like, this might be the happiest moment of that Archie Miller.
It's very possible.
Because I don't know how good they are.
Yeah.
And then also Virginia and Purdue, because I'm curious if Virginia can score more than 50 points.
Honestly, that game will be disgusting. Do not watch it. I am Purdue alum, so I've watched a lot of my Boilers, and those games have been.
They're 4-3.
They've been knocked down, drag out, just brawls.
Yeah.
Purdue's struggling to find, like, he lost Carson Edwards, you know? Like, he's the epitome of go-to scorer in college basketball. So Purdue's trying to find its identity offensively, and those games have just been rock fights.
I feel like
you talk about playing Virginia.
Yeah.
Like, if they get, first team to 50 wins.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Just stop the game. Yeah. Like, honestly. All right, it's 51-48. Virginia wins, and everyone's like, okay, good, because that was awful. Yeah. Like, that just was. And the thing I love about Purdue is I get this sense that if they don't have a Carson Edwards, they're like, all right, we don't really know what we're doing, so we're just going to grab, like, we're falling off a cliff. We're just going to grab you and make sure that you also play horrible basketball, too, and we're just going to tumble down this
mountain.
That's
what it seemed like. I don't know. It's fantastic. Maybe that's the way VCU and Florida State wanted to go, but I don't know. Purdue, now, to be fair to Matt Painter and Purdue, they did start slow last year and then found a groove.
Yes, they did.
As the season went on, so perhaps it's this team, you know, with a younger core, will find its footing. But one thing I wanted to mention before we go, I forgot to mention out the top, but Creighton hired an assistant.
That's right. That's right. We should probably talk about that.
Right. After our last podcast and between this one and that time period, whatever it was, 10 days, the Jays hired an assistant off San Diego staff, Terrence Wrencher. So Preston Murphy resigned on Friday before Thanksgiving. So I don't have a calendar up, whatever date that was. And then 4 days later, the Jays announced that they had a new assistant. And Coach McDermott mentioned after Preston Murphy's resignation that he was going to reach out to some candidates that he'd already sort of interacted with over the summer who had expressed interest in the job, should it come open.
Yeah.
So he reached back out to those individuals, and obviously Terrence Wrencher was high on his list because that happened very fast in terms of those two coming to an agreement and Terrence Wrencher coming on board because now he's a part of the program. Mm-hmm. He joined the Jays on Wednesday. Hiring announced Tuesday, joined the Jays on Wednesday, was on the bench Thursday.
Wow.
And obviously is now part of the staff. So it's like it kind of closes a chapter to a certain sense, because Creighton had been waiting waiting on word from the NCAA in terms of the enforcement staff interpretation of what happened as part of the FBI probe and Preston Murphy's role in it. The details were always they weren't as clear cut as maybe some other schools or some other assistants that were involved in it. The government alleged that Preston Murphy accepted a $6,000 bribe, but then the defense during trial was like, well, it wasn't a bribe. We were saying that this was kind of a deal that we had worked up with Preston and he gave the money back to Christian Dawkins, the agent. And so it was, other assistant coaches who took money admitted in court that they took a bribe and they obviously were convicted of a bribery charge. And so there's a little bit more nuance, I guess, with Preston Murphy and some details that because he wasn't a central figure in the case, you know, a lot of the details involving him weren't revealed during the course of court proceedings. But he was suspended, and he has been suspended for 8 months, and the Jays have operated with two full-time assistants. They've promoted their assistant to the head coach, Steve Merfeld, to take on some more administrative duties during that stretch. I think they made the decision that it was time to get a new full-time.
Did it surprise you that he resigned?
It did, actually, because there hadn't been any movement. Sure. And I thought that, you know, we would see
something first and then...
Right.
Yeah.
And so maybe something has happened behind the scenes that hasn't been made public yet. Creighton's a private university. It doesn't necessarily have to declare with great fanfare that it has interacted with the NCAA. Oklahoma State, when it got its notice of allegations, released it publicly because eventually it's going to have to release that anyway. NC State did the same thing. It released it publicly the moment it got it in July. Those are public institutions that, they have to present the documents if they get them. Creighton's not like that. It's possible that things are happening behind the scenes that we don't know about. The sense that I get is that it's still an ongoing process and we won't know what the end result is for many months. Mm-hmm. So
what do they get with this new guy?
Well, I think a couple things that Coach McDermott mentioned that he was really encouraged about in terms of adding Terrence Wrencher. By the way, he's the all-time leading scorer at Texas, native of the Bronx, and he's had multiple stops over the last like 7-8 years in his coaching career. So I think the idea of having recruiting ties in different parts of the country was appealing to Coach McDermott. His relationship with players, since he's a guy who has done it before. Mm-hmm. He played for 10 years in Europe and in the CBA, I think. So he's kind of gotten where they want to go.
Yeah.
He's walked that same path, and I think his ability to kind of interact with guys, I think, is something that Coach McDermott really wanted too. So they got him.
Yep.
And
he's on the bench now.
Right. It a little bit of a surprise to see it all kind of transpire so quickly. And given the timing of the year, timing in the year, you thought maybe this would be something that Creighton would have wanted taken care of before the year, or maybe even once Preston Murphy decided to resign, that the Jays might wait until the traditional sort of coaching carousel season, which is April.
Yeah.
But I do think that the Jays, Coach McDermott used the word normality, wanted to have a feel of things going back to normal for his players. I think the Jays also have a really important recruiting class in 2021 because that's the class that replaces Mitch Ballack, Tyshawn Alexander, Denzel Mahoney, Damian Jefferson. Like, they need to get started on that group or that class right away. So that was a piece, I'm sure, that played into the decision to move quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
So
two quick newsworthy Nebraska things before, because we won't talk about this on Thursday, I'm sure. Nebraska did get a commitment in the 2021 class. You just reminded me. Don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm not going to try. I'm going to learn and then tell you.
But he's a Japanese player, right?
Yeah, he's from Japan. But he's currently at a college in Ranger, Texas, Ranger College. It was JUCO. 2021 kid who Matt Abdelmassi has been recruiting for a while, knows his family pretty well. This kid's a three-point specialist. He's shooting 50% from three currently in JUCO, which for some context, Gervais Green was like a 45% three-point shooter in JUCO, and obviously that's not quite transcended over. But from what we've heard from this kid, he's one of the better shooters that you can find in junior college, and would add to the 2021 class. He announced on the morning of Thanksgiving, which was a fun thing for everybody to do. But important.
He's from Japan, man. They don't celebrate Thanksgiving.
Right, yeah.
It's not their holiday.
Right. But, Mate Kivas, it's kind of one of those things where I think this is the trend that we're going to see, where, you get Mate Kivas, who's a 40% three-point shooter at Seattle University. Now you get this 2021 recruit who is a, over 50% three-point shooter in JUCO. Nebraska, I think, will often, under Fred Hoiberg, bring in some unknown guy that just has bonkers three-point percentage stats at a lower level and try and bring him up. I think that because those guys are generally not recruited as tough because, I don't think a lot of people believe in kind of just we're gonna look at this one stat.
Yeah, right, but, because I don't know if there's any proven data that says if you're a good three-point shooter at a lower level, then you'll be a good three-point shooter at a higher level. Like,
but
I don't know if that's been proven out.
But I think it's one of those things where, to make like a football analogy, when Mario Verduzco goes and recruits quarterbacks, he doesn't really look at completion percentage. He looks at like their stroke. Okay, what can I work with this? Like, is this fixable? Like these things, like with Luke McCaffrey, that's basically what, everybody wanted him as a wide receiver, but he went and he saw his stroke. He was like, I can deal with that. He's a crazy athlete. Let's do it. I think it's pretty similar with Fred Hoiberg, where it's like, if you can shoot, you can shoot. Fred knows shooting better than almost anybody in college basketball. He's a guy who, when he got to the NBA, he just hung out with Reggie Miller for a summer. And Reggie Miller's one of the best three-point shooters in the world. Fred led the NBA in three-point shooting for one season. So it's one of those things where they get him, got him locked down for 2021. They need that guy. It's a really important recruiting class, and they have him. Number two, Shamil Stevenson is officially not eligible. They submitted the waiver. It got denied. They appealed. It got denied. They then had a last-minute conference call from the Cayman Islands and for one last like verbal appeal, and that also got denied. So he will have 2 years to play at the beginning of next year. So he will be eligible next year. They get him for 2 years. They were not allowed to start the process of filing the paperwork for the media eligibility until he was a full-time student, which didn't begin until August. So that's when they began the paperwork. It was officially filed in October because it takes some time. You got to get your P's and Q's. And now he's official. So it's one of those things where I think had they done something differently, he would have been able to play for a year and a half starting at the beginning of this year. But I think from Nebraska's perspective, it's far more important that he plays for two full years and not just you know, half a year, because he basically, you know, he basically loses a year if you do that, because he only played in four games his sophomore year. So I think it was important that they got 2 years, and also next year's so much more important than this year that you get him coming off. I mean, it's basically the same setup that they had with Iowa State, where they had three transfers coming in the second season and they kind of took off. So I think that's kind of what they're hoping. So it's too bad for Shamil, because he's kind of been hung out to dry by NCAA for a while now. But they finally got a decision. He will not play, which means Nebraska's going to have to deal with what they got to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I go back and forth on whether or not it's a good thing that players sit out a year. I mean, for him, he sat out a long time. So it's almost like you wish that if you sit out a year, even if it's half at one school and half at another because your coach left, that you'd be able to become eligible.
Yeah.
But then again, as you said, for the team, for the program, it was never really about this year. For Shamil, I'd imagine he wanted to play.
You want to play,
as soon as possible. The
general thing that I think coaches believe, and I kind of believe too, is you should be able to transfer and play no matter, like, once. You can transfer from Nevada to Nebraska. You can be immediately eligible to play. Mm. But if you transfer again, you have to sit out a year. So for Shamil's case, I mean, that would actually, you know, mean he'd have to sit out.
That's your proposal for the transfer.
That's my proposal, yeah. That you can transfer once and play immediately.
Okay.
But if you transfer again, you have to sit out.
All right.
Because that way you can take the waiver thing out of it. Because it's a very clear black and white, right. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been a lot of complaints about the waiver process.
A lot. From a lot of people.
From coaches. But I don't get the sense that coaches are 100% on board with the idea of players being immediately eligible.
Yeah.
So what do you want? Like, if the coaches don't want them to be immediately eligible, but they are mad that these waivers aren't coming to get their player immediately. Like,
right. They're mad that people aren't, you know, that people can get eligible until their guy gets eligible. Yeah. And then they're like, you know what? This rules kind of rocks. Right. Like, I'm cool with this.
Yeah. All right. Chris, we had a lot to cover. We've done that.
Yeah.
And we will be back in a couple days to talk more specifically about Nebraska and Creighton.
Full breakdown.
Big time game coming up. We'll see if both teams can handle the challenges that lie ahead of them before that. And we will try to handle our challenges.
Exactly.
That are presented by life. If they played today, though, who would win, Nebraska-Creighton?
Creighton by like 9.
I got Creighton.
It's kind of going. It's going down.
I'm going up a little bit after tag. So
that's true.
Creighton by 12. We'll be back in a couple days.